Hi, I'm Steve Goldstein, and this is the Friday Newscap podcast. Each week, we review the biggest stories with experts, reporters, and commentators to put the news in perspective. Here's this week's episode.
It picked up steam when I saw the increase in rhetoric against our president, especially from two U.S. senators here in Arizona.
This week, I will release my budget. It will include a full commitment to accelerate the state's K-12 investment and restore long-standing cuts from the recession made before many of us were here.
I was beyond embarrassed to hear that what I thought were welcomed and well-intentioned hugs were perceived as creepy and lecherous. I didn't know. As soon as I did know, I have been, and I am sorry.
Personally, I don't think that was a time or place. Some people were made extremely uncomfortable. There was a line of video cameras pointed right at them, and I think that was inappropriate to do it at that time, and it should have been done, you know, somewhere else. It's far too sensitive of an issue. I appreciate that he's trying to make an apology, if he truly is apologizing.
And joining us to talk about Martha McSally and Joe Arpaio running for Senate, as well as Governor Ducey's State of the State address, among other things, are Matthew Benson, former gubernatorial communications director, now a director at Veritas, and former legislative leader Chad Campbell, currently a senior vice president at Strategies 360. Guys, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So now it's official. Martha McSally, we sort of knew this was going to happen, and now officially, as of this morning, she's running for Senate. Matt, what do you make of her chances? What do you make of the approach? Because people will always talk about she has a great story, a great backstory to tell.
Yeah, she's got a fantastic bio, so to speak. I mean, the first female combat pilot, and it's a tremendous story. And I think as a candidate in the general election, she is uniquely positioned to run for the Republicans and try to hang on to that seat. The problem is there's a primary first, and that's where I think the questions are about her and her candidacy. And the entry into this race this week of former Sheriff Joe Arpaio and what that may do to turn this race upside down.
Which we'll dig in on in a second. Chad, McSally represents the district basically that Gabby Giffords represented as well. It is a moderate district, and we always wonder about how well-known she is. She's made some appearances. She's gone after President Trump at times, supported him. Is she a candidate that can get that statewide recognition?
Yeah, I think so. I think to Matt's point, she has a very compelling backstory, her history. You know, it's a great story. And she's going to have the money coming in now. And I do think, though, that with the primary, as Matt alluded to, you're going to see her have to move to the right, though. That's going to be the interesting thing. She's represented this very moderate district, Democratic-leaning district. And even in her speech this morning, she really did play to that Trump base. Because she has to now with Arpaio there, with Ward, who's been there, and how she pivots back away from that in the general and then faces somebody like Kyrsten Sinema, who is a very moderate candidate with the track record that shows that, is going to be the really hard part for McSally, I think, if she gets through the primary.
Yeah, Matt, I mean, I'm wondering what you think the role of the president will be. Her ad that she released this morning included President Trump. She was seated next to him at one of the meetings talking about immigration earlier this week. How much do you think she tries to embrace him and his policies to try to gain some support in the primary?
Well, there's no question she's going to rely on Trump supporters in many respects, because Trump is still popular in Arizona, especially among the Republican base. She's going to need his voters to get out of that primary. And the president really is the $10 million question here, because, look, I know we're going to talk about Arpaio in a moment, but if Trump throws the full weight of his support and his establishment and everything that goes with that, including just the bully pulpit of the presidency, behind a candidate other than Martha McSally in that primary, she is going to be facing quite a challenge.
How big of a challenge might it be, assuming that you're right, that she does sort of embrace the president and all, and tries to get his supporters, does that to some degree mean that every day she's going to have to be answering questions about the latest tweet or the latest comment as opposed to what she actually wants to be talking about?
Yeah, well, that's just welcome to politics in the era of Trump if you're a Republican. Regardless of how closely you've aligned with him, you're going to be getting questions about what you think about the latest thing that he's said or tweeted or you know, told somebody in a private Oval Office meeting. So that's going to be the reality one way or the other, but certainly more so if she aligns more closely with him in order to curry favor with his voters.
Chad, do you think that Kyrsten Sinema tries to use that at some point, either during the primary or during the general?
Yeah, I think that Kyrsten will probably use that to a degree. I think actually that will be used more by the outside money coming in to kind of bash, so to speak, McSally, whoever is, over the head with Trump. Kyrsten's talked about this many times, and it's true. She does focus on policy. She focuses on her own track record because she has a great track record as a congresswoman, and I think she'll continue to do that and show the difference between her and McSally or Arpaio or Ward or whoever it is. And you'll see all this outside money coming in, like it always does nowadays, to try to negatively attack candidates on both sides of the issue. But I do think, to Matt's point, you know, Trump is an albatross right now in the general election in many cases. So if they have to pivot to that base in this primary, appealing to 30% of the population overall, which is the majority of their primary base, though, it's going to be hard to pivot back. And there's a reason why you're seeing people not running for re-election right now in Congress and the U.S. Senate, because they know that in the general election in 2018, they're going to have a very hard time getting reelected as a Republican who's aligned with Donald Trump. And that's going to be the same case here.
I don't disagree with that, but I will point out that a lot of those retirements are coming from Republicans in difficult districts in places
Agreed.
Like California.
Yep.
Arizona is a different animal. Yes, there are dark clouds around the Republicans' prospects in 2018, but this is still Arizona. Registered Republicans still have a significant voter registration advantage in this state. In fact, registered Democrats have somehow actually declined since the last election. So maybe put in a call over there.
Hey,
I'm
working on
party
it.
Or something. but look, unless the Republican nominee is just disgracefully broken and disqualified coming out of the primary, they should have the advantage in this race and most every other statewide race on the ballot in 2018 in this state.
Now, Matt, before we turn to Elvia Diaz to get her take on Arpaio, I have to follow up on that, though, because Sheriff Arpaio, former Sheriff Arpaio, is already bringing up the birther thing again. How can that possibly work in a general election if he somehow stays in the race and wins?
Right. Well, speaking of disgracefully disqualified and broken, Joe Arpaio is the candidate, the kind of candidate I'm talking about, you know, who the name alone conjures up, you know, the racial profiling saga, all of the sexual assaults, many against children that went uninvestigated, the millions upon millions in taxpayer dollars paid out to inmates injured and killed in his jail facilities. That is all coming back to the fore in the event that he makes it out of this primary as the Republican nominee. And I think that for Republicans is the worst case scenario where you could really see Kyrsten Sinema and the Democrats take that seat.
And I would just add two things about Arpaio. First of all, you know, he lost last year in what was a Republican year. If you look at Trump winning, he lost Maricopa County and he got crushed. His name ID outside of Maricopa County is high, but people don't really know who he is in a lot of ways. It's all just kind of this ideological figure they know. If he can't win Maricopa County in an election year where Trump won, he can't win statewide. And on the flip side of that, he is a fundraising gold mine for Kyrsten Sinema. He is the best thing that could have happened for Democrats in this state in the Senate race. And I'm telling you right now, it's going to swing this election. If he gets the primary or doesn't get out of the primary, it's going to swing this election to Kyrsten Sinema, and she's going to win that seat.
That's Chad Campbell. Also here is Matt Benson. It's the Friday Newscap with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Now for another perspective on Joe Arpaio's announcement that he's running for U.S. Senate, we turn to Elvia Diaz, a columnist for the Arizona Republic and a member of its editorial board. She wrote a column about Arpaio and the Senate in the hard copy of today's Republic. Good morning, Elvia.
Hey, good morning.
So I think we know where you're coming from on this, but what bothers you most about the Arpaio candidacy? Is there a personal touch to this as well?
It really is a personal touch, but honestly, I was listening to the other guests that you have there, and I'm actually hoping that it will be Arpaio who wins the primary, so he'll face Kyrsten Sinema, because you're absolutely right. Whoever said it, this is the best thing that could ever happen for a Democrat, because a lot of Latinos like myself are incredibly upset with Joe Arpaio and what he has been doing for many years here to Latinos and undocumented immigrants. immigrants and what have you. So yes, of course, you know, we as Latinos in general are very upset because they have been fighting this guy for so many years, and you know, he has so many political lives. So when you think you knocked him down on one, he, you know, he comes back, and that's it. So on a personal level, of course, it's an insult that he's back, and to politics. On the other hand, I mean, he does incentivize Latinos to go out and vote, and we know Latinos are not going to have a huge say in the primary. This is going to be strictly a Republican race, but definitely in the general election.
Yeah, Elvia, that's the point I had to go to next, because, of course, you've heard this question many times. Many political scientists have brought it up in Arizona before, and a lot of people say that Joe Arpaio lost to Paul Penzone because Republicans got tired of Joe Arpaio, not because of the Latino turnout. Do you think this is, even if it's just for the Republican primary, do Latinos get passionate enough about this, especially if Joe Arpaio wins the primary?
Well, at the very least, Latinos are going to be making a lot of noise and are going to be knocking on a lot of doors. And you are right. Republicans got tired of Joe Arpaio spending so much taxpayers' money. But I think Latinos are going to be reminding everyone and the difference between Joe Arpaio here in Arizona and Roy Moore that we had been talking about is that Roy Moore had an issue that appealed to a broader electorate, and Joe Arpaio's issues in Arizona are about Latinos, and we know how the rhetoric goes, right? If it is about minorities, oh well. And Republicans got fed up with him when it came to money. So that's going to be an issue that Latinos are definitely going to be reminding everyone, you know, that he is the guy that spends so much money, and you know, not just that he's a racist. Because if you say he's a racist, well, that actually appeals and incentivized his core base.
Elvia, finally, do you think there is a clear disconnect there because he has announced that he's running? Does Sheriff Arpaio, do his supporters not really realize some of the negatives we've already talked about? For them, is he some sort of hero, and do you think he stays in the race?
I think he's going to stay in the race. I mean, if he's able to collect the signatures necessary to stay in the race, he will. I mean, I get so many emails, just like so many other of my colleagues. And when I say so many, by the hundreds, sometimes thousands of emails from our Arpaio's core supporters, you know, the Donald Trump supporters, that nothing is going to change their minds. They love Donald Trump, and they definitely love Joe Arpaio. So if you're going to appeal to the 30% of the electorate that your guests were talking about, he's going to stay in the primary, and he has a very remote possibility of winning, but it's a really good remote possibility, and I'm not discounting him.
Elvia Diaz is a columnist for the Arizona Republic and a member of its editorial board. Elvia, thanks for joining us for the NewsCap.
Thank you.
And back in studio with Chad Campbell and Matt Benson, guys. I'm kind of curious, you know, Steve touched on this with Elvia. Do you guys both think that Joe Arpaio is staying in this primary through the end? I mean, there's been some talk that maybe this is a fundraising gambit for him. Matt, do you think he's in this for the long haul?
I'm told that he is. I had the same thoughts when the announcement came out this week, which shocked everybody because, you know, he's hinted at maybe getting into pretty much every statewide race for the last 20, 25 years. and I think people had really written off that he would actually do that now. But I'm told that this is real and he is going to stay in and he intends to win. And why exactly he wants to do it now is still a little bit of a mystery to me. But be that as it may, I mean, and if I can just piggyback briefly on a comment that my friend Elvia made, she is smart to say that she is not taking him lightly. Yes, I agree with her that I think that if he gets the nomination, the Democrats very likely and Kyrsten Sinema take that seat, and I've said that. However, I am also reminded that folks like me and her said similar things about Donald Trump last time around, and here we are, and he is the president. And so sometimes I think in many respects this is a question of, you know, careful what you wish for.
And you know, nothing Arpaio does shocks me any longer. You know, we did the Paul Pinzone campaign, so we ran that campaign against Joe Arpaio last time around. So we witnessed kind of the shenanigans of Joe and what he does. So nothing shocks me. But out of all the things he's done, this is probably the closest I've ever been shocked by Joe Arpaio. So I don't know if he stays in or not. We will see. But I do think because I agree. I said the same thing about Trump. I still regret a tweet I made when Trump announced his presidency saying, as an early Christmas present, please let Donald Trump get the nomination. Boy, was I wrong on that one. But I do think the difference is Joe Arpaio is a known quantity now. And again, you know, he got crushed in the last election here in Maricopa County. And Elvia pointed out it was motivating for Latinos. It really drove them to the polls. They really get energized by Joe Arpaio, and that is true, and it will happen again. But I do also want to point out what also pushed that margin as high as it was wasn't just Latinos. It was Republicans who were fed up with Joe Arpaio. We targeted Republicans in that race that we knew were disenfranchised or sick of Joe Arpaio and kind of tired of his wasting money, as Elvia pointed out, his lack of getting things done. And that mood hasn't changed, is my guess, around Joe Arpaio. He hasn't been gone long enough for people to forget that. So it's not just Latinos. It's just not just Democrats. There's a fairly large segment of Republicans who are fed up with Joe Arpaio, and they'll be there again, I think. And
Matt, yeah, one of them, I'm sitting right here.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. Right to the next me, yes.
And Matt, briefly before the break, and this is not meant to be ageism, anyone's listening out there, but people have brought up the fact that, you know, Carl Hayden was a senator from Arizona into his 80s, but of course he had been in office. He had true seniority, not just his age. He had power. What would it be like to have an 85-year-old freshman senator who lost his last race and is inflammatory? It almost seems like Arizona's already going to be on the short end when it comes to losing Flake and Senator McCain at some point. So where do we go from there in terms of how much that actually hurts Arizona in some ways?
Well, the U.S. Senate may be one of the few places on earth where an 85-year-old is not necessarily among the older members. So he probably fit right in, to be honest. I'll just leave it at that.
Matt Benson here at Veritas, also here at Chad Campbell of Strategies 360. Mark and I will continue the newscap right after this. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. We're in the midst of the Friday newscap with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Joining us, our former gubernatorial communications director, now director at Veritas, Matt Benson, and former legislative leader Chad Campbell, currently a senior vice president at Strategies 360.
And guys, we started the week with Governor Ducey opening the legislative session with his State of the State speech. As expected, a lot of talk about education, some talk about opioids. He called for a special session to run concurrently in the next little while to try to deal with that. Matt, you have worked on states of the state before. What do you think what the governor had to say?
You know, I think what I took away from the governor's remarks was this is a guy who's entering the race, the 2018 race for reelection, from a real position of strength. He clearly didn't come into this speech feeling like I've got to, you know, knock people out of their chairs with some out of the blue announcement. Instead, he stuck with very tried and true issues that are, you know, mainstream, whether you're talking about the economy, supporting education, fighting opioid abuse, supporting veterans. He talked about empowering women and equality at the state capitol and treating everybody with respect. So really, these were issues, what I call 80-20 issues, you know, where 80% of the electorate is going to be with him on these issues. And he provided very little target to the critics and the Democrats and his gubernatorial opponents to go after him on.
Chad, obviously, a lot of the details of what he had to say will come out in a few hours when he releases his budget proposal. But what do you think of the stuff that he was proposing and the stuff he talked about?
Well, I have a slightly different take on it from Matt. I mean, I agree with him in terms of what he was talking about and the overall tone, which I think was striking to me because it was a very bipartisan tone. He you know, talked about working across the aisle several times. He really didn't bring anything up controversial, to Matt's point. But I read that as a different reason. I actually think he did that because he knows he has to appeal to Democrats in this state and independents because of the environment he's operating in. I think, and we see this in the polling we do across the country with my company, Republicans are in a very bad place. We all know that. Their negatives are incredibly high. And so I don't think – I'm not sitting here saying Doug Ducey is going to lose next year, right? But I think it's going to be a competitive race. I think Steve Farley raised a lot more money than people expected him to as one of the Democratic candidates. And so I actually think that his speech was actually an allusion to the fact that he knows he's not as strong as he would like to be right now. He has to reach out across the aisle. He has to appeal to those more moderate people in this state. And he has to distance himself from Donald Trump. And he did that. The thing that struck me the most was he had somebody – a representative from Mexico in the audience, and he talked about good relations with Mexico. How many GOP politicians are doing that across the country right now? That was the most striking thing to me. Doug Ducey set a very different tone. Now, will he deliver on that and actually appeal to Democrats and independents? That's the big question. We'll see as the session moves along.
Matt, let's talk K-12, because the governor has done a lot of media interviews in the aftermath of the State of the State. And he's kind of appeared defensive, at least that's how I read it, when anyone would question how much education funding, they're saying, well, you're just restoring the funding that was there before. And obviously there are some other things we'll get into as far as what he has done. But specifically, critics are saying he didn't do enough. He talked about it, but didn't really provide, again, enough details. How did you read it?
Well, the state of the state is not where you're going to provide a chapter and verse, you know, line by line detail in terms of a particular area or element of the budget. That's coming out today with the release of his executive budget. Now, he did switch things up a little bit different this year, where he came out, I think, the day following the state of the state and said, here's my plan. We're gonna roll out $400 million additional for K-12, and this is how it's going to be allocated, and this is where it's coming from. And so I think that I think what you're seeing and what he pledged in the state of the state was the lion's share of new dollars in the budget are going to be directed at K-12. Now, for the it's never enough crowd that's out there, guess what? It's never enough. And so they're going to come back in an election year, and they're going to claim that he should do more. And so, you know, therein is the rub. I think that the governor, to the extent that there's some frustration on his part, I think he learned something from last year's exercise where he devoted money specifically to teacher pay, and this same crowd really came around and hit him over the head with it, claiming that it wasn't enough and you know, doing the math to say it was, you know, a few bucks a day or whatever it was. So, you know, I think that the lesson he's learned from that is, look, I'm gonna take a large amount of money, I'm gonna direct it to the school districts, I'm gonna tell them to spend it as they see fit. And if they choose to spend it in areas that are not what voters want, then those districts are gonna be the ones that have to answer for it.
And I would just kind of add to that, you know, the state of the state last year from Governor Ducey was, as a person who works in the public affairs world, was a nightmare for him. He came out promising a lot, and he oversold, I think, what he was going to deliver. And he would have been better off if he had just not mentioned teacher pay in the state of the state last year and then just slipped it in the budget at the last minute, even though it was a smaller raise. And I'm saying this from a PR perspective, not from a policy perspective. So I think he learned his lesson, to Matt's point, and didn't do that this year. The question is now, and we all expected him to do something on education funding because he had to. We've all seen the polling. We know where people are at on this issue. The question now is it enough? And I know Matt talked about, you know, the people who are out there opposing this saying it's not enough. But I think it is a legitimate question. Is it enough just to get us back to that pre-recession era funding? Or do we need to start actually investing more around the education system as a whole? And that's going to be the big debate now in this gubernatorial race next year. And I can guarantee you Steve Farley or David Garcia, whoever comes out of that primary on the Dem side, we'll be bringing that up time and time again in their battle with Doug Ducey.
But the dynamic that I think is interesting and one to watch is you're seeing some of the large school district leaders and you know, mainstream folks, the superintendent of Mesa, Arizona School Board officials, right, that group. These are not far right or conservative education folks. And you're seeing some of them peel off. You saw them stand with the governor when he announced his $400 million additional for K-12, saying complimentary things. The school board officials group announced they're pulling out of the lawsuit over school capital. So I think that you may start to see some of the more fringe groups, fringe isn't the word, some of the more critical elements like the teachers union, for example, start to maybe get left a little bit on an island as some of these other folks side with the governor.
And I would say just one more thing to that point. It's exactly what Matt said is happening. I would also say the last thing that the Democratic candidates right now, at least in my eyes, want to do next year is start blaming some of those groups supporting Doug Ducey. They do not want to get in a fight with the superintendents. They do not want to get in a fight with the school administration officials. They need to make sure they're focusing their campaign rhetoric and their policy debate on their opponents and not get into who's doing what at the school level, because they're all working hard and nobody wants to fight with them.
Guys, briefly, because I want to give Mark a chance to switch us up a little bit. But as we're looking at it right now, based on the session starting, and yes, the governor has said he would defer to legislative leaders on certain budget things. You know, he just makes suggestions. But based on the fact he's running for reelection, based on the fact that he is a relatively popular figure in this state, in a Republican-leaning state, is he really in charge of this session even more than many governors have been with other sessions?
I would say yes. Again, I don't think he has anybody in the Republican caucus down there that is kind of his political foil, like previous administrations have had. You know, Speaker Mesnard has been pretty locked up with the governor, the Senate president as well. So, yes, I think this session will be very reflective of Doug Ducey's agenda. And again, that will be both probably a blessing and a curse for him when it comes to actually go out and campaign in 2018.
Yeah, I expect a typical Ducey-led session, which means no nonsense, little drama. They're going to get it done quickly, around 100 days, and they're going to get out and campaign.
Guys, we got to talk about the House sexual harassment training session, which stretched on for 4 or so hours this week. Not finished. They're going to come back next week and do some more. It seemed like one of the big things to come out of this was this question of whether there should be a statute of limitations on complaints. A number of members brought up Roy Moore, for example, as saying, look, this is stuff that happened 40 years ago. Like, why should that disrupt our careers now? Chad, how did you read how that whole session went down? It seemed, just reading, at least reading the tweets, it seemed like it was very bizarre.
Bizarre is one way to describe it, yes. I could think of other things that I probably can't say on air, so I'll just leave it at bizarre.
Anymore, you never know.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I'll start with, you know, Don Shooter gave this heartfelt apology on the speech or the floor one day, and then the very next day he's talking about this statute of limitations on when people can complain, which I, you know, kind of a case of crocodile tears there, maybe. I don't know what to think of the statute of limitations. I'm not sure how you can tell people when they can complain and talk about being harassed and anything else. This is not that's not a criminal issue in and of itself when people bring up an allegation. I think that is, from a legal perspective, just impossible. I don't think there's any precedent or any foundation of that argument. And from a moral perspective, I think it's just absolutely horrible too. The last thing we want to do is to try to shut down people who've gone through this, no matter if it takes them 10 months or 10 years or whatever the time frame is, to come to terms with it. So it's just been a very bizarre few days.
So at my peril, I will wade in on the opposite side of this and say, look, obviously the optics around saying that there should be a statute of limitations in light of what happened with somebody as awful as Roy Moore, terrible optics and terrible time to bring that sort of thing up in 2018. But I think that there is a real question about how legislative bodies possibly referee these things and investigate these things when you're talking about complaints that may involve things people did decades ago in their prior lives with different occupations, or maybe they were in college, or who knows. And how does any legislative body possibly, how does an ethics panel or anything else possibly get to the bottom of something like that? I think that is a question.
Matthew Benson, former gubernatorial communications director, now a director at Veritas, and former legislative leader Chad Campbell, currently a senior vice president at Strategies 360. Guys, thanks for joining us on the NewsCap today.
Thank you.
And we continue with the show. You've been listening to the Friday NewsCap from KJZZ's The Show. It's an original podcast recapping the week's big stories with experts, commentators, and reporters. You can get the full show podcast at podcast.kjzz.org. If you have any questions or comments, please email us at theshow@kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein, and thanks for listening.